Welcome to the Morning Glory Project, Stories of Determination. I'm your host, Betsy Graziani Fassbender. Like in nature, we see determined flowers and vines clinging to life and seeking light, so are Morning Glory people. And in this podcast, I'll interview writers, activists, artists, entrepreneurs, survivors and thrivers, and trailblazers of all kinds. These are folks that have been determined to get over, under, around, and through the obstacles that face them, or to seize the opportunities that come before them. I find these people inspiring and amazing. I know you will too. Today, I welcome to the Morning Glory Project, Anne Reeder Heck. At age 26, Anne was brutally raped by a stranger. Years later, still seeking to heal from the trauma of it all, Anne stood alone in her living room and claimed her desired belief out loud. This is my year of strength. Her clear intention resulted in a phone call notifying her that her rapist had been identified 14 years after the crime. Anne's gripping and uplifting story is one that has sparked national interest, has been shared on the TEDx stage, and is told in her forthcoming memoir, A Fierce Belief in Miracles. Anne's a speaker, healer, and artist devoted to inspiring and guiding women to trust themselves, open to their intuitive guidance, and experience the magic of life through positive intention and a creative, curious spirit. And I like what she says about herself and what she believes, that when faced with adversity, what we believe makes all the difference. Welcome, Anne. I'm so glad to have you here on the Morning Glory Project.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, so rape is not an easy thing to talk about. So we'll spend a bit of time about that, but mostly talking about what you became and how you adopted the title of your book, which is A Fierce Belief in Miracles. So tell me about this event that occurred when you were 26.
Well, I was an avid cyclist. I had just finished my first year in a new position. I was teaching high school chemistry, and it was summertime, and I had gone out for a morning bike ride, and I had a plan for the day. I knew where I was headed. I wanted to go to this sweet little bakery and have lunch and head back. It was going to be a significant part of my day. And I ended up getting a little bit misdirected, and I thought I was on the right path, but I ended up on this gravel road, which, as many road cyclists will tell you, is not a comfortable way to ride on a road bike, is to be on bumpy gravel. And I almost turned around and headed back, but something drew me down that road. And I had a big point of hesitation, which is something that played with me for a number of years. But I ended up going down that road, and a man stopped me to ask for directions. And when I went to get my map and turned around, his fist was in my face. So from there, it was pretty violent, and I lost some teeth and ended up in the emergency room at the hospital after being raped by him in the woods.
Wow. Such a, you know, here you are riding a bike, you know, just, as they say, minding your own business, and your world gets changed in an instant.
Yeah.
So tell me what, obviously you had sustained physical injuries that were pretty profound. If you had teeth knocked out and you were hospitalized, what were those weeks, months right after that like for you?
I think at first there was quite a bit of denial that it even happened to me. I pretty much was in trauma mode and not believing that that actually had happened. And in my mind, I was, I knew it was wrong. And immediately I was in touch with law enforcement and wanted to do everything that I could do to make sure that this man wasn't out committing similar crimes against other people. Mm. So there was that aspect of those months afterwards, but there was also a lot of post-traumatic stress, a lot of anxiety, and then, of course, the doctor's appointments. I had a lot of injury to my mouth, and then there was the anxiety, and about about a year after I started experiencing a lot of pain in my hips and pelvis. And for me, that was just all linked energetically to that event. Mm. So it was the start of a journey that was transformational in so many ways.
I want to go back to something that you said. You talked about how you had a point of hesitation about turning around, you know, on the road that you were on. You like, I'm sort of not supposed to go down that road, but you, it sounds as though you sort of overrode that hesitation and went ahead, and that subsequently that, and I'm going to use your word, that plagued you for a while. Can you say a bit about that?
Sure. There was this whole question that arose for me for years about trusting my intuition, you know, trusting that voice within that says, don't go down that road. You need to turn around. and there was a big hesitation about that day. And I actually did turn around. I started back to where I come from. And then something stopped me and drew me back to that road. And so for years, I questioned that decision and questioned my ability to trust my gut. And there were a number of interesting things that happened around that whole theme of trust for me. And the discovery I made was that I could trust myself, and that sometimes we get mixed signals because there's a message that is trying to help us stay safe, and there's a message that's looking out for the bigger part of our existence and what we might be led into in the world. And
well, let me linger there, because I'm a little confused and I want to understand better.
Sure.
So I'm thinking of there's a terrific book written by Gavin De Becker called The Gift of Fear.
Yes, I love that book.
Many years ago. Oh, you've read it as well.
Oh, yes.
And he talks about this, about how we so often get pummeled by the news or whatever about what we should be afraid of. But in fact, what that often does is it clouds us from our best guidepost, which is sort of this, that internal voice. When you're in that parking garage and you feel that creepy feeling and the I need to be alert here feeling, and how we as people, and particularly as women, I think, tend to disregard that voice, can tend to say, oh, stop being such a baby, or, you know, oh, it's no big thing. We kind of override that hesitation. Mm-hmm. Is that what you feel like you did, or that you were frustrated with yourself for doing?
I think that was a big part of it. You know, I grew up as an academic. I was a straight A student. I was very left-brained and always went for what was logical. And my mm-hmm. map had shown me that that was the most direct route to this bakery I was going to. Mm-hmm. And so hearing my gut feeling say, no, we're not going that way. Let's turn around.
It was a fight between your intuition and your logic.
Exactly. Yeah. Yes.
Gosh, I wonder how many times, and you know, sometimes logic should win.
Absolutely.
You know, there are times when that's the right thing. You know, I mean, if we look at right now, of course, we're in the middle of this COVID-19 social distancing stuff. You know, logic is a good thing right now, keeping us safe and keeping us doing things. And our intuition is to go and hug everybody. So there are times when the logic should win out, but there are times when that intuitive voice is informed, it seems that you're saying, by something more than just the logic.
Yes, certainly.
And what do you think of that as?
What do I think of that voice as, or that?
Yeah.
I think that's that's our inner wisdom. That's the piece that often gets overridden by the logical brain, that voice of the heart that's looking out for us. And it's extremely valuable. And I'm a scientist, you know, I'm trained as a chemist and I like experimenting with things, but there's a real value in listening to the science, to understanding the science, and to working with that logic. And then there's this other part that's extremely important. And I've learned that there has, on my healing journey, listening to my emotion, following my intuition, and trusting were essential.
Trusting your gut?
Yeah, trusting my gut, yeah.
Well, and you also said that at first, There also seems to be another sort of contradictory but simultaneous truth in what you're telling, in that a part of you at the beginning still didn't believe it was real that it had happened, and yet you made the police report and did the logical thing. So there was this, am I describing it right? There's this kind of, on one hand, shock, stunned disbelief, this couldn't possibly be, but this other logical part of you that walked through the steps that you needed to take care of the tragic business that it was.
Sure. And I think that there is, I mean, I think that we are in a culture that often allows our logic to trump our emotion, our head game to trump what's going on emotionally. And I very much did that. I found that I was just overriding the emotional trauma because I didn't know what to do with it.
And what's the consequence of that for you, for overriding that?
For me, it was, I think, a very delayed healing process. It took me many years to really connect with my emotional self and to allow that to guide my process of healing, which is what I really needed to do. You know, I got to a place where I could barely walk anymore years later. Hmm. That was the breaking point for me. I just...
Well, you mean literally you couldn't walk?
Yes, literally. I was having difficulty just going out for a walk. And I had been to see, you know, the doctors and had x-rays and they were, you know, taken all the logical steps. And there was a part of me that just was, that felt so certain, like this gut part of me, that there was a big part of this that was emotional that I needed to pay attention to. And so I began trying all types of alternative healing modalities. In fact, over a period of 14 years, I was trained in, or I was treated with almost 80 different alternative healing modalities. I was willing to try anything. And some of them were helpful. And ultimately, I still was in this place where I felt like I wasn't whole. And that's what I wanted. I wanted to find that wholeness, that part of myself that I felt I had lost. And part of it was physical. It was physically manifested. And part of it was very much emotional, spiritual.
So here you are then, somewhere, I'm wondering what prompted you to stand in your living room that day and say, this is my year of strength. You're saying, okay, I've done these 80 different therapies. I've done this stuff. I'm getting stronger this year. This was sort of a personal proclamation. And you said it out loud, alone in your living room, right?
Sure. Yep. I sure did.
What do you think prompted you saying that?
I know exactly what prompted it. I had my daughter. I birthed my daughter in October of 2003, and it was January of 2004, the start of that new year, that I was so clear that that would be my year of strength. I had to make some change. I didn't know what it was, and I was just putting it out there that I was going to hold the certainty that that would happen somehow. I was willing to take whatever action steps I needed. I was just opening myself to the universe guiding me along. And my daughter being born was a game changer for me. It's just, you know, I was bringing another woman into the world, and I felt very clear that my healing would affect her. And if I didn't heal, that would also affect her.
I'm guessing too that having a daughter after having survived a rape as you did, that it also acquainted with you with your vulnerability again too. That sort of, well, gosh, now I've got a girl in the world, and she'd be vulnerable if she isn't strong. So I have to be strong and teach her to be strong. Is that
yes?
Feel
yes,
so
definitely. Yeah, I was. There was that, and I. And just really feeling that the healing that I do or that you do or anyone does affects more than just ourselves.
So you're seeing this as a spiritual connection too?
Yes, I really felt it as a spiritual connection that whatever I was going to do to help myself would help my daughter and my daughter's daughter, and that was something that had to shift for me. It was just a must.
So you stood in your living room and said, "This is my year of strength." And how long between that and when the phone rang?
2 days.
So 2 days after, and this is 14 years after the rape event.
Yes.
2 days after you say, "Enough is enough, this is the year," the phone rings. Tell me about the phone call.
So it was the same detective who had worked my case 14 years earlier. And he said, "You may want to sit down." And he said, "I want to tell you that we've positively identified the man who raped you." And it was strange to hear his voice, and stranger still to hear what he had to tell me. And yet after I hung up and sat with it, I wasn't surprised. There was some part of me that really got it, like immediately got the connection.
Hmm. The connection between your proclamation and the
and,
call?
Yes. And yes. And the other piece of it was, he said, 2 days ago, we discovered this connection.
So the discovery actually happened probably while you were making your proclamation.
Right.
Look, I live in California, so I can go a little bit woo-woo on it. But there, regardless of how you view such things, there's just an amazing synchronicity about that.
Yeah, absolutely. And it was exactly what I needed. I mean, that was the shift. It wasn't just him telling me that. It was what happened in the aftermath.
So before we get to the aftermath,
yeah,
how was it that they put two and two together and got this fellow at that time?
Well, there's a national DNA database, and my data had been placed into that database shortly after the crime took place. But not every state was online with the nation. And in January of 2004, West Virginia went online. Their DNA database matched up with the nation's, and there was an immediate match.
So all of this was happening behind the scenes. You knew nothing about those laws changing or
exactly
the yeah. DNA pool.
Yeah. Because I found that out later.
So now we're starting to creep up on this fierce belief in miracle thing that you write about, because you're looking at those things all lining up in just a spectacular kind of, like I say, synchronicity.
Yeah.
So subsequent to that, there was a trial.
Yes.
Tell me about that.
Originally, the trial was planned for April, and I was asked if I would appear in court and make a statement. It wasn't required. I could write a statement and have someone else read it, but I felt really clear that this was my work to do. These were my action steps, that I had put out the intention. This is what had transpired, and I was being called out. And that preparing for that was extremely transformational for me. It turned out that the case was delayed from April until November of that year. And so I had quite a while to sit with it, but I needed that time. And what I was doing was writing this victim impact statement, which for me, 14 years after the crime, really had a depth to it that maybe it wouldn't have if it were just a couple years after the crime. But I wanted to be able to put into words how the crime had affected me negatively, how it was so harmful. And at the same time, I realized that I had received a lot of gifts in that journey of 14 years, and gifts that I wouldn't have accessed had it not been for that event.
Can you say a bit about what you mean by the gifts?
There were so many angels that walked into my life because of that, because of my desire to heal. I had some beautiful people that I worked with in my healing journey. I had the good fortune of meeting an incredible teacher who was a Cherokee shaman. And I sat with him weekly for 6 years and learned so many things about myself. But I did those things because I was desperate to heal. And I learned about, you know, friendship. I learned about compassion. I learned about how to trust myself, how to connect with other women in this really powerful way. There were so many gifts that came from that experience that were rooted there. And so that's what I actually struggled with that year, to put into words the way that being victimized had impacted me, because that's what I was being asked to do.
So let me just ask you just a little bit about that.
Yes.
Because I'm fascinated by two pieces of this. One is that the act of putting into words let you see it differently. And you had to have kind of gotten to the place where you could even do that with some time. But I'm wondering what was the impact? What was the injury that you wanted to share with the court and with the perpetrator?
You mean in terms of what I had lost?
Yeah, aside from the violence of the rape and the injury, the physical injuries that you sustained and the trauma after, was there something that you really wanted the court to know what the consequences had been to you?
Oh, sure. I mean, and that was the balance, right? The balance between how I had been impacted in this really horrible way and how I had been impacted in this really helpful way.
So the negative impact, what do you see? I'm thinking that if someone is listening, somebody who's suffered an assault like this, and they may feel that they're crazy for how they're feeling, I'm wondering if you'd be willing to share a bit of what those negative experiences were, what those consequences were.
Yeah, for me, it was years of holding this anxiety and fear in my body, not being able to walk in a crowd, being nervous about going into new experiences, being frightened in the hallways at school where I was teaching just because people were walking behind me, you know, having friendships that shifted directions completely from fun, loving, lighthearted to something that was just more serious and held this tension in it because I had been injured. And then there was, you know, the effect on my family, you know, on my family of origin, certainly my parents, having to share that trauma with my parents and see them in a place where they were distraught by it.
Suffered vicarious pain for you.
Sure. Yeah. They're the secondary victims.
So you ended up going to court then. So you wrote this proclamation, this, how would you call it? An injury statement?
It's called a victim impact statement.
And then you indeed did go to court. And what was it like for you to sit across from the perpetrator of this crime?
Yeah, actually, my husband and I went into the courtroom and sat, and I hadn't realized until a few moments later that the perpetrator was sitting just in front of me.
Wow.
It just didn't register. And you know, I had been curious about whether I would recognize him. Part of my work that year, besides writing the victim impact statement, was to make sure that I could be really grounded and present. It was going into that felt like it was going to be transformational, and I wanted to be fully there. And interestingly, I felt very grounded. I didn't feel like it threw me to see him. It had been 14 years. He had changed somewhat in appearance. It didn't bother me to see him. What was really a transformative moment for me was that he was asked to make a statement. And I had been since April, when I thought I was going to go into the courtroom, from April until November, I was doing this blessing work. I had learned a blessing from a friend of mine, and I felt it was important for me to really neutralize any angst or anxiety or upset or anger that I might have residually hanging on. And I really wanted to be in a place of forgiveness and acceptance with this man. And so I've been doing this blessing process and really asking that he feels that sense of forgiveness and that everything could be neutral when I got in the courtroom.
So that it wouldn't be a heated exchange or another injury of sorts.
Well, not so much that, but just on the interior, on my inner well-being. I wanted to be grounded, and I didn't want to have any negative feelings towards him. And I really had gotten to a place where I could see that, you know, he was wounded. I was wounded. We were both wounded. We shared something.
You saw him as wounded.
Oh, yes. Anybody who commits a crime like that and has, who acts out of anger is holding fear. And fear is, you know, it's pretty prevalent, especially right now. And it's important that, it was important for me to see and understand that, because I too had fear just like him, and I could easily have acted out, and I didn't want to go that direction. And so I did this work, this inner work, before going there, because it was important for me to have that sense of balance within myself and to really know myself and know my relationship with him as being clean and clear, and I wasn't going to have anything hanging on it that looked like anger. And the most beautiful thing happened, because when he was asked to make, if he wanted to make a statement, he stood up and turned toward me, and he said, well, first of all, he said, I need to be put into jail.
He said this to the judge.
For the judge. I need to be jailed for life, because if I am left out, if I'm let go, I will commit a similar crime. So he had this like awareness of himself that kind of was surprising to me. And he turned around and looked at me and he said, there's nothing I can say to let you know how sorry I am. And then under his breath, he said, thank you for forgiving me.
And you had not said that to him.
I had said nothing to him. And for me, those were the most important words. Because I got that deeper connection that we all have this opportunity to connect with one another in this compassionate way, where we can be forgiving and understand that we share these places of fear and these places of anger. All of us have them. And it's something that we have a choice about as far as how we hold them.
Well, I'm really stymied and excited, because I'm hearing something that's kind of, maybe it's obvious to the rest of the world, but it hits me interestingly as you say it, that you, I think that we tend to think of forgiveness as something that we give to someone after they've said they're sorry, but you needed to forgive him before that. And in order to do that, it seems, and you help me if I'm getting this right, you needed to see him as not a victim, but as broken, as fearful, as injured?
Yeah, I would say as fearful, that he was acting out of fear. And truly, forgiveness was essential for me. And I think we do forgiveness for ourselves.
And what do you think forgiveness is?
I think it's about being compassionate with ourselves and realizing that we don't need to hold this anger and angst towards someone, it's more damaging to ourselves than it is to anyone else. He would never have known that I was angry or anxious or upset about that experience through my sitting around the house being angry. it doesn't affect him. It affects me. And so forgiveness was really, it was a process for me. I had to get to a place where I realized that and where I could see the experience kind of, you know, more objectively standing outside of both of us and getting that we had something we shared, that we both shared this traumatic experience, I'm sure. And we had a fear about that. We had an anxiety about it. And out of that comes anger. But when we forgive, we find peace. And that's, it helps ourselves and it helps other people.
Well, that's worth the price of admission right there, isn't it? That peace thing that we all crave. Well, when faced with adversity, what we believe makes all the difference, you say. And it's clear that that's how you've operated your life. I'm so glad that you're not only a survivor of what you've endured, but that you are thriving as well. And I look forward to your book, A Fierce Belief in Miracles, that arrives on the scene in fall of 2020, correct?
Yes, September.
In September of 2020. So at this time we're recording this, it's yet in the offing, but perhaps as someone's listening, it's already available. So thank you so much, Anne, for your time and your generosity of heart and spirit in this conversation. I wish you every kind of blessing.
Thank you, Betsy. It's been a pleasure.
I wish that I had the opportunity to share hours of my conversation with Anne Reeder Heck today. She and I chatted before the interview and then after, and time constraints let me share only a bit of it with you. But let me tell you, every minute I spent with her, I felt enriched. It's like that when you're with somebody who's really examined their lives deeply and have learned from it. But I'm also really fascinated by this. And really, folks, this is the whole source of this whole podcast. The whole reason I do the Morning Glory Project is that I'm fascinated when I talk with somebody like Anne, who's survived something unthinkable, a rape so violent that it knocked out her teeth and injured her pelvis and caused PTSD for a long time. But somehow she was able to evolve from that and thrive after it. Why? Is it something magic that she has? Is it some decision she made, some process she went through? Is it just how she's made? Or is it something that is available to any of us that we could tap into those qualities that let us transcend the experiences that we've had, the traumas that we've suffered, the losses we've incurred? I'm also really struck by Anne's ability to forgive somebody that would do such harm to her, for her to see him as somebody who went through a trauma too. I'll admit that my brain has to do some somersaults for that one. But I'm reminded of a quote that I wrote down and I wish I could attribute to somebody, and I've searched and searched. So if you originated this, I'm glad to give you credit, but or if you know who has. But the quote is this: I never knew how strong I was until I had to forgive someone who wasn't sorry and accept an apology I never received. Who in your life do you need to forgive even if they weren't sorry? Now, in Anne's case, of course, the man who raped her was indeed sorry. He was so sorry that he asked to be put away because he didn't want to commit this crime again, though he had at least one other time. Forgiveness. It's not something we give to somebody else, Anne says. It's something we give to ourselves. Boy, if that's not a big old blossom, I don't know what is. It's a pretty lovely extra bloom. Thanks so much for listening to the Morning Glory Project today. Wherever you are, I hope you are safe and well and provided for. And that wherever you are, you can find a way to bloom.